Good morning and welcome to the Monday, May 5th meeting of the Government Operations and Elections Policy Committee. And Monday, May 7th, I was thinking maybe it's Monday, May 21st for those of you who watch this place. Now, it's a very important day. Before we get going here, a couple of housekeeping details. The minutes from the meeting of April 25th, Representative Nelson, have you had a chance to review those and be willing to move those for approval, sir?
Move approval of the minutes from April 25th, 2018.
Representative Nelson moves approval of the Government Operations and Elections Committee Policy Committee's meeting minutes from a lot of practice here this morning, April 25th, 2018. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, the motion prevails. To give you a little bit of a heads up of what's going to happen here this morning, we have two items before us. The first is going that we'll be taking up will be the members of the Campaign Finance Board, and we anticipate that we will take three of them this morning and two of them when we reconvene later today. What we will also do this morning is before 11:20, we will had a chance to hear the pensions bill. It is my intention to put the pensions bill to a vote coming from committee. I'll explain more about that process and how we're going to be looking at that when we get to that item. But the first thing that we're going to do this morning is ask for Mr. Sigurdsson, the executive director of the Campaign Finance Board, to come forward and just give the committee a little bit of a background. And we'll also bring Mr. Rosen in, who was unable to be here with us today, but is available by a telecommunication with us this morning. So with that, Mr. Rosen, are you with us this morning? Okay, very good, very good. And before I turn it over to Mr. Sigurdsson, one of the things I want to mention, folks, is if members have questions of Mr. Rosen and his candidacy, what will happen is I'll ask you to share the question. I will then repeat the question just because of the sound equipment. We don't have the ability to catch it from the entire committee area. So, well, I will relay those to him, and then we should be able to hear his responses at that point. Good morning, Mr. Sigurdsson. If you'll identify yourself for the record and just give us a little bit of background statutorily and procedurally why we are here today.
Good morning, members. My name is Jeff Sigurdsson, Executive Director with the Campaign Finance and Public Disclosure Board. This morning you'll have three of the five members of the board who are up for confirmation this year. You will have three Republican members and two members who have identified with the DFL party. All of the members must be confirmed by both the House and the Senate, which is rather unique. And all must be confirmed by a three-fifths majority in both the House and the Senate floor. Again, Mr. Rosen is in Washington, D.C., but realizes the importance of being able to answer questions and introduce himself to you as a committee, and so he's able to join us by phone today. And then Ms. Lepic and Mr. Haugen are both here in person and will be coming up to answer your questions at that time.
Thank you, Mr. Sigurdsson. And before I introduce Mr. Rosen and have him talk a little bit about his background, what I anticipate will happen is we'll probably spend maybe 5 minutes or so with the candidates introducing themselves. Members may have some questions. So we're looking at about 15 minutes, 5 for introduction, 10 for questions, and we'll just kind of monitor that situation as we're looking at that. What will end up happening is Mr. Rosen will most likely have to drop off the line, but the other two candidates will stay in the room. As I said, we'll be recessing when we're done to come back to take up the second half of the candidates for the Campaign Finance Board, and it is at that time that we will move all candidates for consideration. So we're taking testimony and feedback today. We'll take more tonight, and then the committee will make its decisions later this evening about moving candidates out. So with that, Mr. Rosen, if you would go ahead and introduce yourself, members in your packets, you do have information as well. Mr. Rosen, good morning and welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm Daniel Rosen. I'm a trial lawyer in Minneapolis. I've been practicing law for 25 years. Graduated of the University of Minnesota Law School. Prior to going to law school, I was an officer in the United States Navy. I am the lead Minnesota partner for a law firm, a national law firm called Huber, Kaplan, Silverman, Kasdan, and Levine. I am in the field of commercial litigation principally. I have served on the campaign finance board since being appointed in August of 2014. I chaired the board from, I believe it was August of 2016 and through the end of 2017. I am honored to be renominated and happy to serve for another term. And I'm happy to answer whatever questions the committee may have for me.
Mr. Rosen, thank you. Members, you do have Mr. Rosen's bio information in your packets. At this time, members, are there any questions for Mr. Rosen? Again, as Mr. Rosen indicated, he is currently serving, and he has been vetted by the committee before and is available for questions this morning should members have questions. Any questions for Mr. Rosen by members? Well, see, Mr. Rosen, I don't see any questions. It looks like you're going to get off kind of easy this morning. So with that, I'll ask one last time if there are questions. Otherwise, Mr. Rosen, we thank you for calling in, and I wish you well for the rest of your day here, and thank you for taking time to phone in with us. Seeing no other questions. Brevity and efficiency. All right. Well, Mr. Rosen, thank you so much.
Thank you. Have a good day.
Very good. The next candidate that we'll bring up, let's bring up Ms. Lepic. Good morning, Ms. Lepic, and welcome to the committee. You are no stranger to the committee. I've seen you here a few times as well. Welcome to the committee. And again, members, if you look in your packets, you do have some background information about Ms. Lepic and her history and her time on the campaign finance board. Welcome. Introduce yourself for the record and then proceed with your testimony.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. My name is Peggy Lepic. Margaret Peggy is what I'm normally called. And I am currently serving on the campaign finance board. I know that you have my bio there to flesh it out just a little bit. I'll tell you a little bit more about it. My husband and I moved to Minnesota about 42 years ago with our three children. And as was much more common back then, I was a stay-at-home mom, and I also became a very active volunteer. And it was these volunteer activities that led me eventually in 1990 to run for the legislature. And I served in the House for 12 years, beginning in 1991, and I chaired the Higher Education Finance Committee for the last 4 years. Shortly after I retired from the legislature, Governor Pawlenty appointed me to the Metropolitan Council, and I served there for 8 years, the last three as vice chair. I am still a very active volunteer. I am interested in public affairs, but I am not particularly active at this point in the political arena. I have served on the campaign finance board since May of 2015, 3 years, by appointment. And I would like to continue because I really do believe very strongly in the importance of the work that the Campaign Finance Board does. And I also happen to find it very interesting work. The agency is charged to oversee and publish information about the money that is raised and spent to influence elections. I think is vital to the integrity of our law, of our elections, and to the public's trust in the decisions that are made in government. I have a few thoughts about the board itself that I'd like to share with you. Because the board is a quasi-judicial agency, I think it is absolutely essential that that there is a sense of fairness regardless of one's political affiliation. The fact that the board must be politically balanced, I think, helps engender confidence in the impartiality of its decisions. I also like that it has representation by people who have actually run for state office and have been affected by the campaign finance laws. It has really been a great privilege to serve on the campaign finance board for these last 3 years, and I would be honored to continue as a confirmed member of the board. I look forward to your questions. Thank you very much.
Ms. Lepik, thank you for your backgrounding. Members, questions for Ms. Lepik this morning? Is this on? Members, questions for Ms. Lepik this morning?
Mr. Chair, I love it.
Any questions from members? Well, Ms. Lepik, thank you. I don't see any. We'll ask you to stand by in case there is a question that may come up. But thank you for being with us this morning.
Thank you very much.
And Mr. Haugen, we'll ask you to come forward here as well. We'll find out if the third time is the charm or if something changes here. Good morning, sir, and welcome to the committee. And I would ask that you again state your name and members. Mr. Haugen has his information available for us in our packets, and ask you to go ahead and do a little bit of background, and then we'll see if there's some questions for you, sir, as well. Good morning. Welcome.
Thank you. Thank you, Committee Representative Driscoll, Chair, and other members of the committee. I'm Gary Haugen, currently living in Minneapolis, but I'm originally from southeastern Minnesota. Grew up in the town of Caledonia, way in the southeast corner, where I graduated from high school there in 1966, and then went on to college, at St. Olaf College, Northfield, where I graduated in 1970. And then later attended the University of Minnesota Law School, graduating here in 1974. And during that time, while I was in law school, I had the privilege of working in Washington, D.C. One summer for then Congressman Al Quie. That dates me a bit, going back a number of years, but that really is my only direct hands-on experience in the legislative arena, and it was a fascinating time and a fascinating place to be with a with a very impressive man. So after law school, I clerked for United States District Judge Donald Alsop here in St. Paul, and then have continued to, since that time, since 1976, continue to practice law here in Twin Cities. I've been with the Maslin Law Firm for over 37 years and handling litigation matters, primarily product liability, mass tort, insurance-related disputes, and assorted of other commercial litigation and trial matters. In addition to that, while practicing the last few years, I taught part-time at both Vanderbilt University Law School and the University of Minnesota Law School, where I currently serve on the law school's Board of Advisors today. As I said, although I've never served or sought elected office, I am, as a citizen, very interested in maintaining the integrity of our campaign and electoral process. And I applaud all of you who have participated in that process and are now holding public office. Minnesota is held in high regard nationally for our outstanding campaign and electoral process. I think I can bring my legal experience and hopefully objectivity to bear in addressing disputes which come before the board, and I will seek to address each of those in a fair and objective, unbiased manner. I look forward to the opportunity of continuing of serving. I was nominated in September by Governor Dayton for one of the Republican name slots, and would hopefully look forward to your confirmation to be able to continue to serve in that role. I'd be happy to respond to any questions and which committee members may have. Thank you.
Mr. Haugen, thank you. I have 17 committee member questions for you.
Good. Yeah, that's right. To make up for the other two. Here.
Thank you, Mr. Haugen. Members, questions for Mr. Haugen? Questions for Mr. Haugen? Seeing none and hearing none, Mr. Haugen, thank you for being here with us today, and that will wrap up this portion of our discussion. As I said, because of scheduling issues and things, we were able to get some this morning, and we will recess at the end of our business for the morning, and then this afternoon we will take, or this evening after session, as soon as there's is available, we'll bring up the others, and we'll take action on the slate of candidates from this morning and this afternoon. So with that, members, we're now going to go to the other primary piece of business that's before the committee, and that is going to be Senate File 2620. And I am going to vacate the chair temporarily here, and I'm going to ask Representative Peterson to chair at this time.
Representative O'Driscoll, like to move your House file, Senate file. Okay, so Representative O'Driscoll moves Senate file 2620 to be re-referred to State Government Finance. And Representative O'Driscoll, to your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. This is a bill that many of you are familiar with. It's been about 2.5 years in the making. It is the 2016, 2017, 2018 omnibus pension bill all rolled into one. And I want to start out by thanking the members of the commission for their hard and diligent work on helping us to put this together. I'd also like to thank the nonpartisan staff who has helped us with this, both House staff and the Legislative Committee on Pensions, for their help and work on this as well. In a few minutes, I'm going to ask that Susan Lincheski and Rachel Barth from the Nonpartisan Pensions Office come forward and explain the bill to you. We also have a number of testifiers. Before we do that, I want to speak to two amendments that are on the list today. We will not be offering either one of those amendments at this time. I spent a good amount of the weekend trying to work with parties to get to a point, and they're not to the level yet where I have comfort in being able to move those. So the bill that's before the committee right now is the exact same bill that was passed out of the Pension Commission and the one that was passed by the Senate. And if the committee agrees, we will then vote at the end of the meeting, or at this portion of the meeting, to move this, as we said, from government operations to the Committee on State Government Finance. One of the things that does happen when you move a pensions bill early in the session like we did is that there are other things that come up, and I've been successful in working with members in the House who have had constituent issues with nonpartisan staff with the plans to find some administrative relief for them and for their needs, but we do have an agreement that was entered into by one community that we need a little bit more time because it just literally came together days ago to make sure that we've got peace in the valley and work with that. And there's another issue that's kind of an ongoing issue that the Pension Commission will need to at some point deal with as well, and we wanted to get a chance to look at that and before we make a hasty decision about how to move forward with that. So, Madam Chair, with that, those are my opening comments. And, again, if we could bring Ms. Lincheski and or Ms. Barth forward to do some backgrounding on the bill. They'll probably take about 15 minutes to give you an idea, article by article, of what's in there. I won't get into the sub-I stuff that's on there. But nonetheless, give members an idea of what we're looking at. And we do have a number of testifiers here this morning as well. And, Madam Chair, what I would ask that we do is that we have member discussion, we hear from the folks from the nonpartisan office and our testifiers, and that we will need to be done by 11:20 because Rules Committee meets, and a number of the people who are on this committee are also on Rules, and then session begins at noon. So we have about an hour or so to be able to, if needed, to discuss this matter. So, Madam Chair, with that, I'm done with my setup.
Thank you, Representative O'Driscoll. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and begin your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative. My name is Susan Lincheski, and I'm the Executive Director of the Legislative Commission on Pensions and Retirement. There are a number of and I'll just introduce my deputy here, Rachel Barth. There are a number of materials that we've prepared for this bill, and I'm hoping that you all were able to get those items. We have a section-by-section summary in the materials, so if there are any questions on specific provisions, please take a look at that together with the summary that's more of a narrative that goes through the bill at a higher level. I'm going to go through the first half of the topics at a very high level, but certainly if you have questions, interrupt me. The bill does a number of things. It's a long bill. As Representative O'Driscoll mentioned, it's been in the making for the last 3 years. We hope that we will meet with some success this year. The bill makes a number of benefit reforms, so it changes the benefits really as a cost-saving measure. The first of those is it eliminates something known as augmentation, which is like a COLA, a cost of living adjustment. A COLA is granted every year to retirees. An augmentation is an increase in the benefit that is granted or is credited to the benefit of a an individual who no longer works for the state. So as a former public servant, but is no longer working for the state. So every year that benefit is augmented by 2 or 1% or 0 in the case of PARA. That benefit is being eliminated prospectively. In addition, the early retirement benefits are being changed slightly to remove augmentation from the calculation of the early retirement benefit. So the early retirement benefit is determined by taking the normal retirement benefit and then reducing it back to the earlier commencement age. In that reduction, augmentation was included, so that is being removed from that calculation. In addition, the interest that the plans pay on refunds, when a person leaves public service, they are able to take a refund of their employee contributions, and they get interest on that from the date that the amounts were contributed to the dates they're distributed to the member. The rate of interest on refunds is being reduced from 4% to 3%, again, as a cost-saving measure. There are a number of changes to COLAs. These are the automatic increase paid on retiree benefits. The COLA percentages are reduced for all the plans, all the large plans, so MSRS General, Correctional, TRA, St. Paul. COLA percentage is being reduced or frozen in some cases. There is a new method for determining the COLA that was approved, heard by the Pension Commission and approved, and this is in the case of PARA. So the COLA there is going to now be tied to inflation, as reported by the Social Security Administration. So there's an attempt to make COLAs a little more in line with inflation, and PARA is making the first step toward doing that. Within the bill, there's also a requirement that there be a study done on COLAs. The thought is that we do want to tie COLAs to inflation, so instead of having a fixed amount every year, we may eventually move in that direction for all the plans. In addition, the start of the COLAs will be postponed until a member reaches normal retirement age. So today, under current law, COLAs are paid on early retirement benefits right away when they retire. Under the bill, that the start of the COLAs will be postponed until normal retirement age. There are COLA triggers that are being repealed. So these are automatic increases in the COLAs that occur when the plans reach a certain funding percentage. Those are being repealed. COLAs, of course, can always be changed by the legislature, but now there's no automatic change in the COLA. A number of actuarial assumptions are being changed, and these seem to get quite a bit of press. The plans right now are at an 8% investment return assumption, except for teachers' retirement, which is at 8.5%. The actuaries, the governor's blue ribbon panel, there's sort of universal consensus that those rates are too high, that they should be reduced to a lower rate. The Pension Commission approved a 7.5% investment rate of return, so that is in the bill. In addition, the amortization period, this is the period over which the plans amortize their underfunding. That is being stretched out again to another 38-year period for all the plans. There are a number of funding sources available in there, or they're being appropriated in the bill. In a couple of places, but I won't go through these in any detail, but employer contributions are being increased, and then they are being funded by state payments. So there are increases to nearly all of the plans in the employer and employee contributions, and then the state is funding those. There are three ways they're being funded. One is direct state aids are going to a couple of the plans. St. Paul Teachers and PARA, Police and Fire will get direct state aid payments. And then, as I mentioned, the contribution increases are being funded by an appropriation to a number of state agencies and then also through a pension adjustment revenue formula. They're being the state is funding the school district employer contribution increases.
Okay, Ms.
Madam Chair, thank you. So the next big part of the bill, Articles 14 and 16, deal with volunteer firefighters. Most of the language consists of the recommendations from the state auditor's working group and mainly just brings the statutes into conformity with actual practices. The other provisions included are the City of Austin provision to allow its fire state aid allocation, new language to allow the Cromwell and Wright fire departments to merge, the benefit correction for the City of Brook Park, and then the City of Eden Prairie will be allowed to increase its annual benefit amount from $10,000 to $15,000. Article 18 of the bill deals with special legislation for individuals or small groups. So these provisions just fix employer errors that resulted in exclusion from either a pension plan or a benefit within the pension plan. Article 15 of the bill contains the provisions relating to Fairview. These provisions reduce the enhanced rate of augmentation for former employees of the University of Minnesota Hospital and Clinics under MSR's general who were transferred to private employment with Fairview Hospital. The rate, which is currently 5.5% or 7.5% depending on the individual's age, will reduce by 0.75% each year until the rate is zero, which will occur January 1, 2025. So those benefits will no longer be augmented after that date. Articles 6, 9 through 13, 15, 17, and 19 contain administrative, non-substantive, and technical changes. So just a few highlights. Making certain Department of Corrections and Department of Human Service positions eligible for MSRS correctional coverage, updating interest rates, and then revising language to be consistent with the Federal Hometown Heroes Act. And then finally, as Susan mentioned, a majority of the provisions in the bill were carried over from the 2016 and 2017 pension bills. But there were a few new provisions that the Pension Commission heard and approved of this session. And just to give you kind of an overview of what those all include. It extends a reporting deadline for the Clearbrook Fire Department. It permits a MNSCU employee the option to elect TRA coverage. It permits members of the para-defined contribution plan who are at least age 65 to take distributions while still working, which is consistent with federal law. It expands the investment options available to members of the closed Hennepin County Supplemental Retirement Plan. It extends para-police and fire coverage to part-time paramedics and EMTs employed at Hennepin County Medical Center. It exempts certain St. Paul City and school district temporary employees from para coverage because they are already covered by their union pension plan. And then finally, deletes a requirement in a 1992 session law that a successor employer of the Swift County Benson Hospital employees provide pension benefits comparable to para benefits. And that's kind of the other chunks of the bill.
Thank you. Okay, are there any member questions at this time? Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. or Madam Chair, and Representative Driscoll and maybe Ms. Leslencheski. Just so everybody understands this, when we reduce the assumed rate of interest or assumed rate of return, how does that affect the pension plans? Does it make them look better or make them look worse as far as the funding levels?
Representative Driscoll?
They're pointing at me to deliver the bad news. When you reduce your rate of return, you're not earning as much, and so when you're not earning as much, it shows on an actuarial and an accounting basis that your funds are not as well funded. I've oftentimes kidded in this process, if we want to fix Minnesota's pension problems, let's just say we want a 15% rate of return, we can show a surplus. The reality is that where the rates of return on average nationwide are coming down, in these plans and for investment targets because of what market conditions are. And Minnesota needs to true that up and to show that we are actually addressing that issue as well. So, again, you can have any number you want, but the reality is what you got to really be managing.
Thank you for that. Representative Nelson?
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Chair Driscoll. It looks like this, the bill looks, from what I've heard and what I've seen and from the last 3 years, that's it's good work being done by the Pension Commission, and hopefully we can get this passed and put the relief out there for the cities and all these employees so that they know their pensions are going to be safe.
Madam Chair.
Representative Driscoll.
I think that Representative Nelson is speaking so glowingly of this bill because he's been recently reassigned since to Pension Commission since the resignation of Representative Thiessen, who sat on that commission. So just in the way of full disclosure.
There you go.
Madam Chair, if I could just, before we bring testifiers forward, one other thing that's very important to understand on this is that this is a situation, and it did take 2.5 years to bring it to where it is today. And for every $1 or for every additional $1 of money that's coming in from public money, $3 in benefit reductions or other cost savings are being realized on here. So the trade is a 3-for-1. Save $3 for every $1 that you put into the plan and into the system. And this is also going to provide us some very good relief within the plans. And last year, when the state of Minnesota went out to in September to sell bonds, S&P, the folks who are a rating agency, in the narrative, in the letter reviewing Minnesota's condition, said Minnesota needs to address its pensions. Recently, Moody's, the two big ones are Moody's and S&P, has also issued a piece on Minnesota saying that Minnesota needs to address its pensions issues. And that's what this bill does, is to help us with that and to provide immediate relief if this bill gets signed by the governor.
Thank you, Representative Driscoll, and thank you, staff. You have been wonderful, and we really appreciate all of your work. Representative Pugh.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just wanted to make a comment for the record in addition to what Representative Nelson mentioned about how important this is to cities and counties. I don't want for us to forget the impact that this will have on school districts throughout the state of Minnesota as well, and we greatly appreciate your terrific work. Thank you.
Oh, Representative Quam.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And one of the things I was curious about, I noticed this is a Senate file. And what are the things that were in the House file that were taken out? I understand a lot of the things are added to for specific instances. And I do see two amendments that were in our paperwork. But was anything taken out of the House file that's in the Senate file?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Quam, the way that pensions work is any bill that's introduced either in the House or the Senate that has pension-related implications is immediately referred to the Pension Commission, which is the House and the Senate bipartisanly working on embedding these issues. And the bill that comes out of the committee is a House file and a Senate file that are the same. Since the Senate passed it first, that's why it's the Senate file. It's the race to the finish line. Whoever passes it first, that becomes the file that it's known as for the rest of the session, and that's what we have here. Those two amendments that we were looking at are, again, trying to resolve some issues that have they're not quite ready for prime time yet, but resolve issues that have been discovered or have been worked out since the time that the bill left Pensions Commission. And we're not offering those today, so.
Mm-hmm. Representative Quam, any follow-up? Okay. Any Representative Sandsted, did you have some? Okay. All right. Well, thank you very much. And then next we'll have the plans come up. And we ask that on our testifiers that they limit their comments to 2 minutes. So if you would just want to make your way forward, and you can go ahead and start and state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Good morning, Madam Chair and members. My name is Erin Leonard. I'm the Executive Director of MSRS, and my colleagues and I are going to kind of take turns and touch on specific points about this legislation and the importance of this legislation. So thank you for allowing us the time to comment. We intend to provide a brief history of the bill itself, how we came to this point, discuss stakeholder support, the resulting future savings of the bill if it becomes law, and what that means to the state of Minnesota. So first, we'd like to take the opportunity to thank all the stakeholders who have contributed to the development of this bill. Special thanks to Chair O'Driscoll, Representative Ross Peterson, and members of the Legislative Commission on Pensions and Retirement, the boards of each of the plans who have been working on this for a few years, and all the employee and employer groups for their time and attention spent on pension issues over the last few years. This bill is the result of 3 years of work involving much discussion and analysis of all parties to reach this agreement on this comprehensive sustainability package. Throughout this process, many have asked, why are the pension funds in this position? I thought we were better funded than other states. And that's true. We are better funded generally. However, our most recent experience studies indicated that we needed to change two major assumptions, the first being the assumed rate of return, going to a more conservative rate of return, as well as extend our mortality, so our all of our employees, both retired and active, are living longer, and those increase our liabilities. The bill before you is a comprehensive package that modifies benefits and contributions to address the increased liabilities and moves the retirement funds to a sustainable path. It includes provisions that affect all plan members. Active employees will be contributing more. Benefit forms will make early retirement more expensive and less attractive for employees. Future cost of living increases will be less for both current active employees as well as future retirees. And the state is committing to fund employer increases for 5 of our plans. So we appreciate your support of this legislation.
Thank you, Ms. Leonard. Morning.
Morning, Madam Chair and members. My name is Jay Stoffel. I'm the Executive Director of the Teachers Retirement Association. First, I would also like to thank Representative O'Driscoll for his leadership and Representative Peterson for their work on the Pension Commission in creating a fair and balanced bill. Senate File 2620 is important and necessary legislation. It contains needed reforms. The bill in its present form must be passed and sent to the governor. As Ms. Leonard mentioned, we have been working on a pension bill for 3 years. This year, from the very beginning of the session, we have had complete and unanimous support from all stakeholder groups. The support includes, this includes support from all 4 pension boards, organizations that represent actively working members, organizations that represent the retired members of the plans, organizations representing school districts, cities, and counties. The governor has also expressed full support of the bill in its present form, which contains recommendations from his Blue Ribbon Panel on Public Pensions. To sum up, the bill has unprecedented full support from all stakeholder groups. It's time to pass Senate File 2620 as it is. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Morning, Madam Chair. Good morning, members. I'm Doug Anderson, Executive Director of the Public Employees Retirement Association. And I, too, would like to express my gratitude to Representative O'Driscoll for his work on this bill over the years, as well as you, Representative Peterson, on your work on the LCPR. My testimony will be focused on the financial implications of this bill. The provision changes that you heard about include employee contribution increases, member benefit reforms, employer contribution increases, and state funding. Together, the changes are expected to reduce the present value of unfunded liabilities by over $8 billion when measured using plan proposed assumptions over a 30-year period. This would be the largest pension reform package ever accomplished in the state of Minnesota. Approximately $3.4 billion of the over $8 billion in savings would be recognized immediately in the next actuarial valuations. Funding ratios would immediately increase, and unfunded liabilities would immediately decrease. The remaining improvement in funding status would occur gradually over time. When comparing the value of employee contribution increases together with member benefit reforms on one hand to employer contributions and state funding on the other, the ratio is nearly 3-1, as noted by Representative O'Driscoll. This approximate 3-1 ratio holds regardless of what assumptions are used or what period of time is considered for this comparison. The 3-1 ratio means that nearly 75% of the funding status improvement resulting from the changes in the bill is attributable to employee contribution increases and member benefit changes. The changes in the bill would improve the future funding status of all 9 pension plans. And finally, again, as noted by Representative O'Driscoll, bond rating agencies have been paying very close attention to the increasing unfunded liabilities of the state pension plans, and passage of this bill would be viewed very favorably by those agencies. Thank you.
Thank you. Welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. As the one holding the closing position today, we all agreed that my job would really be simply to express our deeply held gratitude. So on behalf of over 500,000 of the active, retired, and former members of the 4 retirement plans plus of Minnesota, we'd like to express our deep appreciation for the pension provisions represented in SF 2620. In particular, I'd like to reiterate our gratitude for several who are present today who played such big parts in this. Representative O'Driscoll, now Chair Russ Peterson, The LCPR staff have worked tirelessly on this for 3+ years. It seems like much more, I'm sure. The House staffers who have worked with our legislators, colleagues, and caucuses, and the countless members of the House of Representatives who have kept their doors open to us throughout this process, hearing all sides of this important issue, and devoting so much of their time to crafting a solution. All of this to drive to one critically important goal, the long-term sustainability of Minnesota's pension plans. We're very proud that the product of this work, the bill before you today, represents good, effective public policy, true bipartisanship, and a principled, balanced solution to a keenly important issue. It takes into account, importantly, the needs of our key stakeholders for whom we are all financial stewards, our members, our employers, and we always remember the taxpayer. So with that, we ask for your support today. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Schertz. All right, and next we have Commissioner Myron Franz, followed up by AFSCME representatives.
Good morning.
Welcome, Commissioner.
Madam Chair, thank you very much. Myron Franz, Minnesota Commissioner of Management and Budget. I'm really here to testify on behalf of the governor, on behalf of the Blue Ribbon Panel, and as Commissioner of Minnesota Management and Budget. And so, Madam Chair, I think my math says that's 6 minutes, but I don't really need I don't really need that long.
Not that math.
Good morning, and thank you, Chair O'Driscoll and Chair Peterson, for your work on the Pension Commission. Obviously, I want to take this opportunity to thank everyone who's worked on this. The governor supports this bill, and he intends to sign a standalone version of Senate File 2620 as currently written when it makes it to his desk. Those are the happiest words I've said this session. This bill has been several years in the making, we know. And during that time, the pension systems, the Legislative Pension Commission, the governor have all proposed measures to improve the financial health. I commend the commission leadership, Chair Rosen and Vice Chair O'Driscoll, for the hard work that they've done in negotiating this bill. The bill before you, which passed the Senate unanimously, does have the support of the pension systems, employee unions, retiree groups, and employer associations. I want to thank the many people who have worked behind the scenes on the Pension Commission staff, the stakeholder groups, the pension boards and staff, and my staff at MMB. They've worked tirelessly to get this bill in its current shape, and that's no small task. But I do want to mention thank you to the Blue Ribbon Panel. In 2016, the governor convened this group of business people, and they came together to review the system from an outside perspective, from people who were not involved and didn't participate in the system, to give their views to help in the debate. It was Professor Colleen Manchester from the Carlson School of Management at University of Minnesota, Tom Borman, attorney at Maslin, Edelman, Borman, and Brand, David Crosby, managing director at Piper Jaffray, James Campbell, retired president and CEO of Wells Fargo, Brenda Brannon, a chief wealth management officer at North Shore Bank of Commerce in Duluth, Sam Kaplan, attorney at Kaplan, Strangis & Kaplan, and Maury Lanning, former Minnesota representative and former chair of the Legislative Commission on Pensions and Retirement. Today, the Blue Ribbon Panel had published in the Duluth News Tribune a letter in support of pension reform, so I commend that to you to read as well. But they recommended a number of changes, all of which have been adopted by this particular bill, including the assumed rate of return down to 7.5%. But the whole idea of a shared sacrifice where the employers, the employees, and the retirees all share in making this sustainability package work for the future, so it puts all plans on a pathway to 100% funding, is a critical component. You've also heard me talk about the fact of the unfunded liability with the rating agencies. Chair O'Driscoll has also mentioned that. And although they affirmed our ratings last year, they made it quite clear that we need to address this issue going forward. And I really anticipate a positive response to any action by the legislature this year with the rating agencies. So the bill before you reduces the liabilities immediately upon being signed by $3.4 billion by the sustainability package. So I'm really confident that we'll be able to go to the market this summer when we sell our bonds and hopefully maintain the AAA credit rating we have and maybe even get another one. So to conclude, the governor appreciates the legislature's work on pension reform and in particular Senate File 2620 that reflects years of hard work and negotiation. from all the different groups. So maintaining this broad coalition is crucial to ensuring this bill becomes law. And I offer any assistance, and if that means not showing up, I offer that as well to help support this bill. It's like I'm sort of feel like I'm the lawyer that in front of a judge. The judge agrees with your argument. The first thing you should do is say, thank you, Your Honor, and sit down. So I hope I haven't destroyed this good work that's come together today. And with that, I'm happy to take any questions, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Commissioner. All right, seeing none, I think we'll continue on with our testifiers. And next on the list is Sarah Lawrence and Julie Blyle. Hi, please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. Excuse me. For the record, I'm Julie Blyle. I'm Legislative Director for AFSCME Council 5, but I'm here today representing the Public Employees Pension Coalition, a group of unions and public sector groups and affiliated organizations that have come together in support of the bill today. In short, we want a clean bill as introduced. We support full funding as included in the bill, and we want you to also recognize the sacrifices that we as individual employee groups have made to come together in support of this bill. I'm going to take the remainder of my time. A letter is being handed out to all of you, which you can go ahead and read the letter, but I'd like to, for the record, state the names of the organizations, and I ask Representative O'Driscoll to bear with me because he's heard these names, and the list has gotten longer each time for the last 3 years, but for those of you on the committee, this will be new. In support of the bill as introduced, AFSCME Council 65, AFSCME Council 5, Education Minnesota, Minneapolis Federation of Teachers, Minneapolis Committee of 13, Pension PAC, Interfaculty Organization, Police Officers Federation of Minneapolis, Minneapolis Firefighters Local 82, Minnesota Professional Firefighters Association, Middle Management Association, Minnesota AFL-CIO, Minnesota Government Engineers Council, Education Minnesota Retired, AFSCME Council 5 Retirees, Minnesota Nurses Association, Minnesota State Troopers Association, Teamsters Local 320, Minnesota Police Fraternal Association, St. Paul Teachers Pension PAC, MMRA, Teamsters Joint Council 32, Public Employees Pension Service Association, Retired Educators Association of Minnesota, Minnesota Association of Professional Employees, Minnesota Conservation Officers Association. Thank you, committee members.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, as Ms. Leverage is standing here, as you can see, Ms. Ball is used to reading that list.
My name is Sarah Leverns. I represent the 14,000 members of AFSCME Council 65 who live in Greater Minnesota, from International Falls to Albert Lea, East Grand Forks to Winona, and Silver Bay to Pipestone. When this bill was heard in the Pension Commission, Chair O'Driscoll asked us to get personal. So I'm going to tell you about a public servant that I love. My husband, Denny, retired as a captain on the Duluth Fire Department after 30 years of service. He went out on disability because he tore up his knee for a third time on the job, and the surgeon said he couldn't fix it well enough for him to be a firefighter anymore. Since his retirement, my husband's had that knee replaced and a hip because of overuse as a firefighter. He is now looking at having both his shoulders replaced for the same reason. Going into burning buildings for 30 years takes a toll on your body. But it doesn't just take a toll on the body. Duluth firefighters are, as are most firefighters and police officers, first responders. My husband went to a call at Target and found his grandmother on the floor. He was able to revive her, but she died shortly thereafter, which was devastating. I'll let you in on a secret. The vast majority of people who have a heart attack and end up being helped by people like my husband don't make it. That's very hard for those first responders to deal with. But they continue to do everything they can to try and make sure that the person they're ministering to is one of the few who makes it. So when you think about how, when you decide how you're going to vote on this bill, I want you to think about the police officers and firefighters, but also the employees who get up at 2 a.m. and work an 18-hour day in a blizzard plowing snow, giving love to students with disabilities who hit, bite, and kick them every day, getting down into sewers when they back up, and on and on and on. Minnesota's public servants work hard and earn a modest pension. The legislature needs to make sure they get it. And I want to say thank you to Chair O'Driscoll and all the people who worked on the bill.
Thank you very much. All right, next on the list we have Mr. Brian Rice.
Brian Rice, representing the Minnesota Professional Firefighters and the Minnesota Police Fraternal Association. I worked on pension issues for 36 years, and this day is very, very significant. I do have a couple handouts, and I'll be real brief. One is a letter from the Minnesota Professional Firefighters. Mr. Parsons is here, and let me just say this on things. This body owes a special obligation to police and firefighters for this reason. These employees are not covered by Social Security. I've repeated that before, but it can't be said enough. They look to this legislature to set their pension benefits, unlike a number of other employees. And it's absolutely critical that their fate is in your hands. So retirees, the group I represent, 800 professional or retired police officers, surviving spouses, their average age is about 74 years old. Their pension and what they get for a COLA is solely dependent on you. And the aid in this bill that the governor put in, an extra $9 million, the employer contribution increase, the employee contribution increase, these retirees are taking a reduction to 1% permanently in their COLA under the bill. It is a sacrifice, but it's a shared one, and very important. The professional firefighters, we've heard a lot about them. Mr. Parsons here, the letter is there on record. They too, there's 2,000 full-time firefighters in the state. Minnesota Professional Firefighters has 42 locals representing 1,700 of them. They're key providers. And I'll just leave you with one document that I think is very important. Ms. Leonard talked about how our pension funds are well-funded. It's this chart that shows the Minnesota pension funds are about 75-80% funded. And if all you knew in this fact was true, that would be okay. Governor Carlson was an expert on pensions and always said pension funds should be 80-90% funded, and that was adequate. Well, that's not adequate anymore. That was 30 years ago when we had a growing workforce and there weren't as many retirees. Now the retirees are living longer. The workforce is growing more slowly. But if there's one thing I can leave you with, it is the second page, I believe page 8, and this is why you have to pass this bill. This chart shows, so we're 80% funded on our mortgage, let's say. We paid off 80%, but we got to pay the rest of the 20%. Right now, Minnesota is only paying about 75% of the mortgage payment. So think about that a second. If every month you're only paying 75% of what you're required to pay your mortgage, you won't have your house in real short order. It won't happen. And so what's critical in this bill is Representative O'Driscoll's bill lowers the liability long-term by $6 billion and raises contributions by $2 billion over the next 30 years. And what that's going to do, and I think it was you, Chair Peterson, pointed out that we're right on the cliff here at 75%. Look over your shoulder. You know what states those are? Illinois, New Jersey, Kentucky. You've probably read about them. But with these two fixes, we get into the red zone, and thank you very much. It's a good bill, and Representative O'Driscoll drove a very, very hard bargain, but a very fair one.
Thank you. And next on the list, we have Lonnie Duberstein with okay, you don't want to speak? That's fine. Okay. All right. Well, next on the list is Rick Heller.
Good Rick Heller, unofficially represent the 26th Epsilon, Minnesota Statute 120B15, or House File 1072, and also the Print Disabled, on the Higher Education Act of 2008. I don't know if this is off topic, I don't think it is, but because the MSRS is on this sheet, that has to do with the state retirement system. Over a year ago, I filed a complaint with Minute. I have access to the site of that for people. Their web page is not accessible. We're complying to Minnesota Statute 16E.03 Subdivision 9, which requires state agencies. And Minute don't get back. And obviously, the chairs, I'll copy them on that to do a data request to see where they went with that. But I think it's relevant that that's a state agency, that's something you might want to consider next year. If there is a word analysis done every year where they certify that their website's compliant, we work with Minute to see if that's something perhaps they can create. I believe they can self-monitor themselves, but create a self-monitoring process in place, not just for that state agency, but for others. It would be automatic, like a continuous improvement plan, and like education does. That way, you don't have to police it on a case-by-case basis. But thank you for the opportunity to speak on this.
Thank you, Mr. Heller. Is there anyone from the public that would like to testify on this bill? Okay, seeing none. Any member questions? Representative Mason.
Thank you, Madam Chair. We obviously, or maybe you don't know this, we get a lot of emails and contacts regarding the pensions. And I know that there's been a lot of support for this bill, and so thank you to everybody that's worked on this. But there's one point that I think one of the testifiers alluded to, and I'd like to make clear. Are retired people going to be getting less in the future as a result of this bill?
Representative Driscoll.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Mason, can you define when you say we'll be getting less? Less what? I'm just looking for a clarification.
Less in their the pension payments that they expected when they retired.
Representative Driscoll.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Mason, thank you for the clarification. The formulas for calculating the amount of money that an individual is eligible for pensions have not changed. What will have changed will be, in some of the plans, the date of retirement, that if an individual chooses to retire early, there may be some, what I'll call, penalties for early retirement that were built in that are a part of this bill to incentivize people to continue to stay working, which we find out anecdotally that most people are because of other benefits that are provided by employers, including the state. Will they be receiving less? Yes, the COLAs are coming down, so retirees will see all the way through all of the plans a reduction. Some have already started that reduction process prior to this bill through previous legislation that we passed. Others are catching up with that through this bill.
Okay, Representative Mason. Any other further member questions? Representative Pugh.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Chair O'Driscoll, I just would love clarification. We heard a number of testifiers reference varying degrees of billions of savings. I believe I took a note that Mr. Anderson, our testifier, represented an $8 billion savings. I think I heard the commissioner represent a $3.5 billion savings and someone else a $6 billion savings and not having the knowledge that you do it all on pensions. I'm just wondering if you could kind of square this up.
Sure.
Representative Driscoll.
Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Vice Chair Pugh. Which number do you like best?
The $8 billion, of course.
Well, let's do this. Let's call Mr. Anderson up and see where he got his $8 billion number from.
Welcome back.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'll start with the $8 billion number, then I can break it down a little bit from there. That was the exercise that was attempting to quantify the contributions. On one hand, the employee contribution increases and benefit reductions, and compare that to employer contributions and state funding. And so that was a measure of all the different changes that have been described by Ms. Lincheski, valuing them over a 30-year period and putting a present value on that under the plan assumptions. And so there was $6 billion of savings resulting from employee contributions or benefit changes, and $2 billion that was contribution increases overall. So the $8 billion was $6 billion from benefit reductions and $2 billion from contribution increases. Then that $8 billion, some of that is savings that is recognized immediately. So that's the what actuaries and accountants look at, is breaking that down into what part of that component is tied to benefits that have been earned to date. So, for example, if you're changing the way a COLA is valued to a retiree, that's based on all the earnings that they've had since they completed their service. So that was the $3.4 billion number. So when the actuaries, this bill becomes a law and passes, they would look at it and say $3.4 billion is something they recognize right away and change the liabilities right away, whereas the rest of that savings would be coming in gradually over a 30-year period.
And Madam Chair, if I might.
Representative Driscoll.
And I referenced a 3-to-1 ratio, and in Mr. Anderson's testimony, he talked about $6 billion and $2 billion. That would be the 3-to-1 ratio. It's just a matter of when an accounting, from an accounting practice, gets booked for savings.
Thank you, Representative. Okay, and I just, you know, I wanted to also bring up the money that it cost us by not passing something. Do either one of you have that answer?
Madam Chair, I'll give it to you more in word, a lot.
A lot.
and if I could, I'll background that. Some of it we can quantify because we know where COLA levels are, we know what benefit levels are, we know what augmentation is, and so every year that augmentation continues to stay in place, those increased liabilities, not reduce them. Every year that COLA stay at the current levels they are at, that increases liabilities, does not reduce them. It's hard right now for us to quantify what impact it will have on the state's credit rating if we don't pass this bill, given the fact that both S&P and Moody's have started waving the flags in our direction that you need to do something. Those are the ones that we won't be able to quantify, and hope we never have to quantify, because we get this bill passed and signed by the governor, and we can take those imminent but not immediate types of impact from the state's credit rating.
Thank you, Representative Driscoll. Any other further member questions? Well, I'll just add thank you to everyone in this room that I know played a role in coming together to find a bill that I think that we can all agree to. And I want to thank Chair O'Driscoll for his work on the commission as well. And seeing no further member questions and other public testimony, I think Representative O'Driscoll renews his motion that Senate File 2620 be re-referred to State Government Finance. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed say no. Motion prevails. Thank you. And members, we will have a couple of things. So this room will be locked during the committee recess, so members can leave their materials here. And Robert Moylanen had a conflict, so he sent a letter. And members can grab one from our CA Amanda Tinsley, and you can read between now and after session. And we will be reconvening about a half an hour after session adjourns.
And fair, if I
Representative Driscoll.
Members, I want to underscore everything that Chair Peterson said. We don't know for sure how long the session is going to go. But we will. I'll make an announcement on the floor as to what it's going to be. I'll make sure that everybody's got at least 30 minutes from the time that we're done on the floor. If all of a sudden we get in at 3 o'clock, you know, it might be 4 o'clock, just give people a chance to take care of some other things. But stay tuned and remember that we're halfway through the interviews for campaign finance, and we do need to take action, so I do need members to come back and be a part of that discussion with the candidates and to be able to consider recommendations this evening as well. It will not take long if the first round was any kind of indication, so your help and cooperation on that would be greatly appreciated. And so, Madam Chair, with that, I have no other comments and I'm ready to have you to recess to call the chair.
And we will recess. All those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? No.
I will call to order and reconvene the Government Operations and Elections Policy Committee for Monday, May 7th, 2018. When we left, we had a chance to get through One list of candidates for the campaign finance board. We took up other business recess, and we are now back to take up the final discussion and presentations. And Mr. Swanson, if you are here, we'll ask you to make your way to the testifying table. Again, members, in your packet is information about Mr. Swanson for your consideration today. He'll make a little bit of a presentation, and then members, if you have questions, we will go from there. Good afternoon, Mr. Swanson. Welcome to the committee. If you'll state your name for the record and then proceed with your background, if you would.
Yes, thank you. My name is Stephen D. Swanson. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. Thank you for the opportunity of coming to introduce myself to you. And after I do that, I'll stand for any questions that you, Mr. Chairman, or any members of the committee may have. I'm a retired Hennepin County District Court judge. I was appointed in July of 1989 and retired in 2007, basically to go work with a USAID-funded project in Kabul, Afghanistan. I was fortunate during my career as a district court judge, the Supreme Court had a policy that you could take a one-year unpaid leave of absence as a judge. And I did that, and I was fortunate to go to Bosnia and Herzegovina and work on a Department of Justice project training judges in Bosnia on a new criminal procedure code. And then I was very fortunate to be an international judge on the court in Bosnia and Herzegovina. That's what sort of triggered my interest in working internationally. I moved here in 1971 with my soon wife-to-be from Brooklyn, New York, where we were both in Volunteers in Service to America. I was born in an Army hospital in Jackson, Mississippi. You can tell I have spent no time there to speak of. I think we were there for a year, and after my dad mustered out, we moved back to our home in Ashtabula, Ohio, which is a port up in the northeastern corner of Ohio on Lake Erie, and at that time it was the largest or one of the largest taconite receiving ports in the United States, and taconite was then trained in the Pittsburgh Youngstown. So I knew a little bit about Minnesota at that time, but only through taconite. I went to school at Miami of Ohio, got a degree there. Then I got my law degree at the University of Cincinnati. Following that in 1969, I went to work in a VISTA program in New York City, where VISTA allowed me to go to NYU for a master's in law half-time, and the other half-time I worked with community organizations in Brooklyn. After we moved here, I started with legal aid and worked as a legal aid attorney for several years, and during that time, all the legal aid programs in Minnesota started the Legal Services Advocacy Project. And I was the first supervising attorney of that project, and I lobbied full-time at the legislature and before administrative agencies probably 1976 to 1986 or 1987. So I developed a deep appreciation for the legislature. I have great respect for it and the members. It's a very difficult job, and I understand that. And I just took a walk through the tunnel to the state capitol just for old time's sake. It hasn't changed a lot. After I left legal aid, I spent a year as a full-time administrative law judge in 1988. Then I was appointed to the bench, served there until 2007, worked for a USAID project in Kabul, Afghanistan for 2 years, came back and worked as a full-time senior judge on Hennepin County District Court when Judge Fred Karasoff was called up and went to Kosovo for a year. Then I worked for another USAID project in Lebanon, lived in Beirut for most of the year, came back, worked again as a senior judge for a year in Hennepin County, then went and worked with a project in Kosovo for a year and a half, came back, worked a little bit as a senior judge, but there wasn't a lot of work. So I applied to be a temporary administrative law judge with the Office of Administrative Hearings, and Chief Judge Tammy Poos hired me. So I worked there as a part-time administrative law judge for 3 years until May of last year. I left there because there wasn't very much work. They had a full complement of full-time ALJs. I was looking for something to do, frankly, to continue in public service, and a friend of mine said, you know, there's an opening on the campaign finance board. And so I looked at that, and I said, that sounds really interesting. I'd like to do that. Applied, was appointed, and I'm now here for confirmation. I will tell you, because of the jobs I've had over my career in Minnesota, I've never been involved in partisan politics. At Legal Aid, because it was funded by the federal government, we were covered by the Hatch Act. When I became a judge, that's a nonpartisan elected position, I thought it was completely inappropriate to be involved in partisan politics in any way, the same as an administrative law judge. So I've been a public official as an administrative law judge. I know a little bit about the reporting system, but I've not been involved in partisan politics. I wanted to be on the board to continue with public service, but also because I have great respect for the election process here in Minnesota. I've seen it in other parts of the world and other states. We have a fine system here. I really want to be involved in that system. And I thought my experience as a judge would be helpful to the board in terms of its fact-finding and investigative responsibilities. So that's why I applied. I respectfully request that you recommend me for confirmation, and Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'll be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Swanson, for being here with us today, and not to put any pressure on you, but the other three candidates that we had in front of us today had no questions, so let's see if there's any questions for you today. Would you have one, Mr. Swanson? Mr. Representative Nash.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. Sorry, I just came out of Mr. Chair. Mr. Swanson, you spent a lot of time in Cincinnati, it sounds like.
I did 3 years.
So here is the important question for me. Are we Skyline or Gold Star chili, and what all do you put on top of it? Because that's important stuff.
Mr. Swanson.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Nash, I was an Empress, or Camp Washington was my favorite. But if you had to go to a chain, the nearest one to the law school was the Skyline, so I probably spent more time in the Skyline than I did any place else.
The toppings?
You know, I'm a five-way minus the onion. And
it is getting close to dinner time. Maybe we can take this discussion offline. Representative Nash, have your concerns been quelled, sir?
Mr. Chair, yes, thank you. I'm just trying to bring a little bit of humor back to the...
What, you're saying this committee doesn't have humor?
Pass.
Other questions for Mr. Swanson that might be a little bit more on topic? Seeing none and hearing none, Mr. Swanson, thank you. Appreciate
thank you,
it.
Mr. Chairman.
And as we had mentioned earlier today, Mr. Moylan was not going to be able to be here. You did have his letter, and so I'm assuming that members have had a chance to review that as well. And the next course of business would be, if there isn't any member discussion, to look at doing a moving of the candidates. And I would like to keep with the theme that we had last year, that we recommend all candidates be removed without recommendation. For members' benefit, I understand that the Senate is considering doing the same as we've done earlier this week, later on this week, which means we will have the potential of having a full and appointed and confirmed campaign finance and disclosure board heading into the campaign season. So, members, with that, if there isn't any other discussion, I have Representative Nelson.
Well, thank you, sir. Do we need to vote on these separately, or do we do it all as one? Can we do it all as one?
We will do them individually because they are individual recommendations for different terms. And what I'm planning on doing, Representative Nelson, is just taking them in the order that's on the agenda and the order that we heard from them. So with that, I move that Daniel Rosen be appointed to the campaign finance. I move that the appointment of Daniel Rosen without recommendation happen to the campaign finance board and public disclosure. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed? The motion prevails. I also move that Peggy Lepick be recommended without recommendation, excuse me, to be moved to be appointed to, I'm trying to get you out of here as fast as I can, folks. Sorry, I'll slow it down. Let me try that again. I move that Peggy Lepick, without recommendation, be referred to the campaign, be appointed to the campaign finance board. Try this again. When I said it's close to dinner time, I have not eaten yet today, and my blood sugar is really low. So, with that, let me try one more time. Peggy, we're going to get you voted on here this time. Trust me, Peggy. I move that Peggy Lepick, without recommendation, to the campaign finance board. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? I also move Gary Haugen without recommendation to the campaign finance board and campaign finance and disclosure board. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
I move Stephen Swanson without recommendation to the campaign finance board and disclosure board. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
I move Robert Moyland without recommendation to the campaign finance board and public disclosure. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? The motion prevails. Ladies and gentlemen, before we adjourn for the day, I want to take an opportunity to thank some folks. I do believe this may well be our last meeting for the year. I could be wrong, but as it stands right now, from what I can see, this will be the last meeting of the year. I would first of all like to start by thanking Representative Nelson as the lead on here. You and I have been able to do some really good work bipartisanly along with our colleagues on here, and I greatly appreciate that. Mr. Gelbman, I appreciate your support and your work on here. Nobody better than you to come up with some creative amendments throughout this process, and I've got a few of them that I have stuck in my drawer. When I need a laugh, I pull them out, so thank you for that. I'd also like to thank our CLA, Megan Plotz, for her work on this, and for our committee administrator, Amanda Tinsley, and for Chelsea Whitman, the GOP researcher on here. And I'd also like to thank Santa and the other folks who have been pages for us. And George is here, and he's been a page. And I'd like to thank Ms. Dyson and Mr. Gehring, although Mr. Gehring is not here. So, again, with the thanks of me and the committee, greatly appreciated. And with that, ladies and gentlemen, we are adjourned. Okay.